Just a few days ago, health officials in the U.S. were warning us that obesity is on the way to becoming America's number one health problem. You could almost hear the rest of the world saying, too much to eat? That's a problem? What about people living in places where a balanced meal, much less a cheeseburger and fries, is only a dream? The most recent report on global health from the World Health Organization emphasizes discrepancies like these. Take life expectancy. A girl born in Japan today can expect to live for 85 years. A girl born in Massachusetts, 81. But a girl born in Sierra Leone, only 36 years. Why such a difference? Well, in part, it's that infectious diseases such as AIDS and TB kill many more people in poor countries. But that's not the whole story. Chronic diseases common in developing countries, such as heart disease, stroke, and tobacco-caused illnesses, are now a major killer in developing countries as well. AIDS is the number one infectious cause of disease among adults worldwide. But it doesn't strike uniformly. In some South African countries, people are dying at rates not seen since the bubonic plague of the 14th century. And if these people had access to treatment and basic health care, adequate food, clean water, as people in rich countries do, the spread of the disease might be slowed. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about global health, including the spread of AIDS across much of the world and what's being done to slow it, as well as the latest from the Global Polio Eradication Program. Maybe you didn't know that one existed. That's a bright spot in the picture, if there is one. That is it's a worldwide vaccination program that's on track to wipe out polio all over the world by the year 2005. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Robert Beaglehole is director of the Department of Chronic Disease and Health Promotion at the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. He joins us today by phone from Vesancy, France. Welcome to the program, Dr. Beaglehole.
Indeed. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Jim Kim is the director of the Department of HIV/AIDS at the WHO in Geneva. He's on the line from Geneva. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Kim.
Thank you very much, Ara.
And Hamid Jafri is the chief of the Polio Eradication Branch at the National Immunization Program at CDC in Atlanta. He joins us by phone from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jafri.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Beaglehole, you're editor-in-chief of the most recent World Health Report. Give us an overview of the health of the world.
Well, the overall situation is quite encouraging. In general, things are getting better. As you indicated in your introduction, though, there are some gross inequalities in health status around the world. Inequalities, gaps between the better off and the poor, which are really totally unacceptable as we start the 21st century. You gave the example of the girl in Africa versus the girl in Massachusetts. We can do a tremendous amount now to reduce that gap. Of course, the underlying causes of these gross inequalities relate, as you indicated, to economic issues, to food issues, to education issues, to gender issues, to cultural issues. We need to be doing much more to resolve the underlying causes of these gross inequalities. At the same time, by building strong health systems, which will deal with both the infectious disease epidemics and the very, very important chronic disease epidemics that you mentioned, we need to put a lot more effort into building systems, healthcare systems, which, of course, are not yet available to people in even rich countries. For example, the United States. Not everyone gets a decent health cover there. But the situation in much of the rest of the world is much, much worse.
I'm always struck by the childhood mortality figures.
Yep. There are about 10.5 or 10.8 million deaths every year in children under the age of five. Most of those are preventable with information we have now about interventions that will work. This is a shocking indictment of the current status of global health. Mm-hmm. We could prevent the vast majority of those child deaths tomorrow if we just had the will, the energy, the resources, the infrastructure, and the health systems to do that.
So where is the breakdown in this? Don't we have the, you know, world organizations that contribute to this or not?
Well, we do. We have the World Health Organization, which is funded by 192 member states. It is grossly underfunded for the tasks that are ahead of us. We have an international development agenda, which is directed towards the Millennium Development Goals, which will respond to many of these causes of death and disability, particularly in the poorer countries of the world. We don't yet have the resources we need to deal with these issues.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised to find that you have chronic diseases, heart disease, stroke, cancer. Doesn't matter where you live, what age.
Exactly
you
right.
Get that.
You talked about obesity trends in the United States being just appalling. The same situation is global. The most important causes of death in almost all countries of the world are these chronic diseases. There are 57 million deaths each year in the world. 60% of those are due to chronic diseases, like heart disease, like stroke, like cancer, like diabetes, and obesity, of course, is one important contributing factor. We think of these diseases as being the causes of death in rich men in rich countries. In fact, they strike each country, every country, men and women. And again, we know exactly what we need to do to control these chronic disease epidemics. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's a huge gap between what we know and what we do.
Jim Kim, every time we hear the AIDS figures, the HIV infection rates, they're just staggering.
Yeah, and you, absolutely, Ira. And the thing is that we've now been living with this epidemic for 20 years. And while it's staggering and while the destruction that it's causing in developing countries is really a fundamental challenge to our generation, we also have more tools at present and more global commitment to doing something significant about the epidemic than we've ever had before. So we're really at a time of great possibility, but also we know that tackling this epidemic in all its complexity, this is not an illness or a disease that we can prevent with a vaccine. It has to do not only with treatment, which is, involves taking medicines over a lifetime, but it involves the most intimate aspects of human social behavior. So it is one of the most difficult epidemics that we have faced and one of the most difficult problems, but there is really, truly great hope. The price of medicines has come down dramatically. The political will, ranging from activists who take over buildings to President Bush, have all agreed that tackling this epidemic is the top priority, and we all agree now that we must treat people with HIV. So the possibilities are great. The damage is tremendous. We hope that we can intervene at this point to turn around some of the destruction that is happening right now. But, for example, in some countries, 60, 70, 80% of all hospital beds are filled with HIV patients who are dying. Children who come to the hospital are often sick because of HIV disease. Healthcare systems are buckling under the weight of this sort of morbidity and excess mortality. So we have to act quickly, and we have to work together to take decisive action right now.
Well, the Bush administration did say it was going to put many billions of dollars into drugs, but is aiming them toward not generic drugs, but labeled drugs. Wouldn't you get a much better bang for your buck if you went for the generics?
Well, you know, the jury is still out on that. There's going to be a meeting that's coming up this week, and I'm in constant communication with my colleagues in the United States around the President's initiative, and we are assuming that it's still an open question. At the World Health Organization, we've worked hard to provide service for the rest of the world. There are generic drugs now that we all agree, including the pharmaceutical industry, the research-based pharmaceutical industry, the so-called big pharma, as well as public health practitioners and the generic industry, that it is okay, legally anyway, to use generic copies of antiretroviral drugs in developing countries. Mm-hmm. We have a problem because the process by which we normally assure the quality of those drugs is done by drug regulatory authorities in developed countries. But because the patent laws still are in effect in those developed countries, those regulators cannot do the same sort of quality tests that they would do if the drugs were legal to import. So what we've done at WHO is brought those same regulators from the European Union, from Canada, from Australia, And under the WHO umbrella, they have looked at the quality of these drugs, and we found that they're fine. Now, the issue for the U.S. is simply to try to make a tough decision as to whether they also meet FDA requirements.
Sounds
and
like
it's not a closed question.
Yeah.
We're still talking about it.
So you're being very diplomatic about
yes.
this.
Well, you know, I'm an international civil servant at this point. I'm not an NGO person, but I'm telling you exactly what the real
yeah.
situation is.
Can't you buy them in Canada like the little old ladies do here in our country?
No, you can't buy these generic drugs in Canada either, because you can only buy them in countries that are poor and that have a public health emergency around HIV.
Yeah.
But what we've done is, you know, we've brought European, Canadian, Australian regulators into India and looked at these drugs, and we found that they're very good quality. So we're very hopeful that the decision will be made that all funders of major HIV treatment programs will decide to use these very, very good quality drugs.
Mm. Hamid Jafri, tell us about this big effort by next year to eradicate polio all over the world.
Yes, I think news that at this end is really good. I think we are approaching towards making public health history again after smallpox eradication. Polio virus would be the next virus that is about to be eradicated. Tremendous progress has been made. When we started, when this global eradication was launched in 1988, every year, there were about 350,000 cases of paralysis, we estimate, were occurring in about 125 countries. And in 2003, this is down to less than 800 cases of polio in six countries. And even in these six countries, 75% of these cases are linked with just about five provinces. So it's really localized even within these remaining countries, big ones being, of course, India, Pakistan, and Nigeria, the three major endemic remaining countries.
And you think you can get it wiped out?
I think it's we are close. Of course, as the last mile is always the hardest, we have challenges remaining. But we are making progress. Mm-hmm. We are right now. The battle is in the toughest spots in the world. We know the strategies work. They've worked in all sorts of settings. We've succeeded in conflict-affected countries like Somalia, NDR, Congo, in tropical, densely populated countries with slums like Bangladesh, China, enormous populations. We've succeeded. So we know that the strategies work really well. Now this issue is down to the really marginalized, underserved communities, where the challenge is to build to reach children in these remaining pockets of disease.
Mm-hmm. What about, you know, we keep hearing whenever we talk about international things, we talk about the world's biggest country, which is China. Is China facing any new challenges health-wise?
Well, China has I can speak to polio eradication. China, mm-hmm. when they made the decision to eradicate polio, they really lined up their highest level political commitment, and they mobilized their communities. And within a matter of 2 years, they completely cleaned out the country. They
wow.
did massive campaigns, and then China since 1995 has been polio free.
Ira, let me say something about
yes.
China, the most important country perhaps in the world. Just under 10 million deaths every year in China. 7 million of those deaths now are due to the chronic diseases, heart disease, strokes, and cancer. They have 1 million also deaths from injuries and 1 million deaths from communicable diseases. Of course, their priorities have been determined by SARS and avian flu,
right.
but their most pressing long-term challenge is how to deal with cancer, how to deal with heart disease, how to deal with stroke.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Mike in Wantagh, New York. Hi, Mike.
Hello. How you doing?
Fine.
My question was, it sounds like a great thing that we're going to try to save everybody's life and everybody should live to 90, but don't we need to have a worldwide program to limit the new people coming online, you know, with birth rates? Otherwise, we're going to overrun the earth more than we already have.
Gentlemen?
Well, it's an interesting issue. In fact, the rate of population growth is declining rapidly, and as the economies develop, as women get educated, as they have access to contraceptive choices, birth rates decline dramatically. So population growth has slowed enormously. We're not going to be overrun. We do need to think about sustainable development and how everyone can share equally in the bountiful resources that this planet has. But the issue now is more a distribution of wealth rather than restricting population growth. That will happen automatically.
Thanks for calling, Mike.
Okay.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We're talking about the sort of a report card on the state of health. One thing we always talk about when we review the state of health is malaria. It's like the silent killer, because no one here talks about it very much in this big country. But it is still a tremendous killer, is it not?
Yeah, it's a tremendous killer in certain parts of the world, and we made great progress in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, and then we've gone backwards, and it is a priority for WHO, and we have effective interventions, and we have effective ways of preventing children from being infected. We have bed nets which are known to be work, but they still are expensive, and they're still not available everywhere they're needed. So there is still much more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Is it a matter of getting the drugs to the right places, or teaching people how to clean up the standing water, things like that?
Well, it's everything. We have to prevent the infections wherever we can by dealing with the spread of mosquitoes. We have to make sure that the children who get infected get the treatment they need so that they don't succumb. It's a nasty, nasty infection, but there are ways of dealing with it.
I heard we had a climatologist come on once, a disease expert with him, saying that global warming is causing some diseases to show up where they never showed up before. For example, mosquitoes now working their way higher up a mountainside where they would not be able to survive before.
Well, it's absolutely true. And there are tick-borne diseases that are occurring in parts of Sweden, for example. They've never been there before. Climate change, if it continues, and it certainly is a very real phenomenon, it's expected to continue. There's no reason to think that it won't, given the response to these issues, will have an important influence on global health over the next generation. It's one of these long-term issues, growing slowly. We need to take steps now to protect future generations.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a short break, come back and take lots more of your phone calls. We're talking with Robert Beaglehol of the WHO, Jim Kim also at the WHO, and Hamid Jaffrey was at the National Immunization Program at the CDC in Atlanta. So stay with us. We'll come back and talk more about the state of the world's health, compare it to some stuff that's going on here in this country. So don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about global health. Looking forward ahead to next week on Monday's Talk of the Nation. Join Neil Conan and his guests when they talk about the ABCs of jury deliberation. As I say, we're talking this hour about global health with my guest, Jim Kim, who's director of the Department of HIV/AIDS at the WHO in Geneva, Hamid Jaffrey, chief of the polio eradication branch at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and Robert Beaglehol, director of the Department of Chronic Diseases and Health Promotion at WHO in Geneva. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. Let's see if we can get some calls in this afternoon. Hi, Adrian in St. Louis. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, initially in the U.S., and I'm supposing another Western nation, HIV/AIDS affected middle-class, educated citizens. Now the greater health disparities is among poor and educated people in these developed countries. If we, how can we expect to be leaders in world health if this growing epidemic is disproportionately affecting those people?
That's a great question. I'm an anthropologist, Ira, in addition to being a physician, and I've been watching this HIV epidemic with an anthropologist's eye as well. And there's really been some astonishing developments over the past 20 years. One of the things I think that was so astonishing was that when the disease was really among marginalized populations, the move toward taking a human rights perspective and protecting those who were found to be HIV positive was really a wonderful movement within the United States and other developed countries. But I think the even more profound shift has come in the early 1990s and the mid-1990s when we began to have treatment available. Even at that time, it was mostly gay men, activists around HIV, began talking in the mid-1990s and late 1990s about the need for compassion for poor people in developing countries who also suffer from this disease and do not have access to therapy. And in a project that I worked on in Haiti, we began treating Haitians with the triple combination therapies in 1998. And now, really led by a small group of activists, the whole world has changed. And instead of simply marginalizing and castigating poor people in poor countries with HIV, there is this humanitarian shift to offer everybody treatment. I think that this will be remembered as a signal event, something akin to the civil rights movement, when our notions of our humanity and our relationship to others was shifted in some fundamental way. Now we have the extremely difficult task of actually delivering those therapies, but as Dr. Beagle-Hole mentioned, one of the good things about HIV treatment, and especially that's a special concern for those of us at WHO, HIV treatment requires a lifelong relationship between the healthcare system and the patient, and requires the capacity to deliver chronic care like you would deliver for a mental health patient or a diabetes patient or a hypertension patient. There's $20 billion on the table right now, and a great proportion of it is for HIV treatment. Certainly the president's plan is $15 billion. The Global Fund is $5 billion. The World Bank has $1 billion. And this is not all for HIV treatment, but a good proportion of it is for HIV treatment. And the way I look at it is, rather than seeing it as an impossible challenge, I see it as the best opportunity we've ever had to truly extend the notion of our own humanity by saying, you know, poor people suffering from the worst of these diseases deserve to have a healthcare system that can deliver not only HIV care, but in the long run, diabetes care, hypertension care, all those things that make for a life free from these common disorders that the services for which we take for granted in the first world. So I agree with the caller that it calls to question some basic issues about our humanity. If we can't do this, I think our generation will always be remembered as one of the most unfeeling and uncaring in history. But we're doing it. The good news is that money is on the table, and now we've got to solve the problems of actually delivering those drugs one by one.
In fact, there's a little news bulletin today that the FDA has approved the first rapid test to use saliva to test for the presence of the virus.
Right. You know, Ira, the
20-minute
great
test now for
right. These are great new developments. And, you know, the thing about HIV treatment, in addition, some people have been saying that a focus on HIV treatment really detracts from prevention. And we think it's actually going to be just the opposite in developing countries. You know, the difficulty to get people tested. I mean, I remember in the early 1990s as a young physician, the most painful thing for me to do was to provide counseling for someone who I wanted to do an HIV test on, because we simply had nothing to offer. It was painful. It was difficult. There was a huge barrier even for me psychologically in going and talking to this patient. But then after 1996, when we had triple therapy combinations, it became a completely different situation. And now, with our 3x5 initiative, in which we're trying to do our best to help all partners and funders and everyone get together to treat 3 million people by 2005, we've really shifted the balance so that even in the poorest of countries, we don't have to go to people and say, we want to test you for HIV, and if you find that you're positive, you will die. We can now say, we want to test you for HIV because we're committed to treating everybody over time for the disease if you're found positive, and if you're negative, what a wonderful piece of news that will be. Mm-hmm. So it's shifted the balance, and these new rapid diagnostics are just what we need, because we need to be able to do it quickly and to do it in field conditions that are not optimal. So we welcome that, and we also think that that's going to contribute to the fundamental frame shift in understanding of how to deal with HIV in poor countries.
1-800-989-8255. Sarah in Indianapolis, you're next on Science Friday. Welcome.
Hi, I actually have something to say about the comments that were just made, and then another comment. I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer. I served 2.5 years in Lesotho in southern Africa. And there is some possibility for treatment in those countries, but in Lesotho, there's so many more reasons why people don't want to get tested. Culturally, it's multi-layered why people don't want to get tested. And there aren't a lot of options for them for treatment if they do come out HIV positive. It's available in very small pockets of the country. So it's still an uphill battle for HIV and AIDS help if you are positive. But what I discovered when I was there and what I've decided is that prevention is so key to the problem because, you know, people get infected at such a young age that really, you know, education for children at very young ages so they understand what's going on and what's happened to the people around them because they've seen people, you know, die around them that really behavior change and, you know, the idea of condoms and the use of condoms and why prevention is necessary, I think, will really only be reached with the young populations.
Interesting.
I couldn't agree more. And the problem that the caller points out in Lesotho is precisely the problem that we're tackling. We feel that in order to encourage people to know their status, and one thing that we do know about prevention is that knowing your status is by far the most powerful tool that we have in preventing HIV infection, knowing that you're positive or negative and acting accordingly and doing behavior change once that piece of information is known is by far the best preventive tool. Once we make treatment available in many more centers, what we found in almost every situation, Brazil, for example, where they're offering universal access, programs that the group Doctors Without Borders have been setting up, and programs that I have worked on myself, what we find is that once widespread treatment is offered, stigma and the desire to get treated does change. There have been pockets of problems. There are places where treatment has been offered and testing has been slow. But again, in our minds, because of the enormity of the problem, these are simply problems that we have to solve bit by bit. One thing I would say, though, is the caller points out something that we must remember. In the United States, once treatment was available, the efforts around mass campaigns in the U.S., for example, for prevention really did die down. I mean, I remember in the early 1990s, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing billboards and commercials and messages about prevention and safer sex. But then after 96, they didn't become part of our consciousness anymore. They really went away. And I think we've really dropped the ball in the United States in many ways on prevention. And we absolutely cannot do that in developing countries. And I think we've learned. I think we've learned that with the advent of treatment, you have to redouble efforts at prevention. Mm. And that's certainly what the WHO is recommending.
We're talking about Health of the World this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I think one of our callers was making, though, is if you have this population in the United States, it's well-educated, well-fed, well-bred, is, you know, highly, you know, motivated and still spreads here, how can you stop that, you know, in a third-world country?
Well, I mean, the pockets in which HIV is continuing to spread are those areas in which, again, I think we've really dropped the ball in terms of continuing, redoubling our intensity around prevention. We must continue to do that. And, the notion of whether or not it's possible to do this in developing countries, well, we're never going to know. And we're never going to know for sure. And all we can do is to look back and say, well, where have we made mistakes? And just continue to tackle the problem every day.
Okay, Sarah?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. So you all sound like you're very optimistic about the future here.
Anna, if I may just add, in terms of what we've learned in the whole experience of polio eradication, and I think I know that Dr. Beagle-Hall and Dr. Kim are very carefully at WHO looking at the whole polio eradication experience. And I think it is really a sort of shining example of how countries have come together to work on a common objective. Institutions within countries have come together. And so far, it truly is the largest partnership in public health, from private sector with Rotarians really stepping in, providing more than $600 million. There are millions of volunteers, there are advocacy, the UN agencies, world governments, they've all come together. And there is a sense of equity, so that there is excitement within the communities themselves of being part of a global effort. And I think those lessons learned of mobilizing massive public health interventions, mobilizing communities, I think are now very good lessons for other public health programs to learn. The surveillance system for picking up polio cases around the world is right now a surveillance system that essentially touches every district around the world and really promises a future for because viruses like AIDS viruses and the avian flu virus and SARS, those lessons have taught us that there are no borders that are seen by these agents. So inter-country cooperation, inter-agency cooperation is key. And certainly the involvement and engagement of these pockets of underserved communities, these pockets that are sustaining transmission of these agents, linking with them, linking with their leaders, representatives, their trusted members is in fact the step where the polio program is right now to meet its final success.
Ira, I would say that I'm cautiously optimistic. And one of the reasons for saying that is that there are no great mysteries about the major problems that we face in terms of HIV/AIDS, how it's spread, or what it's caused by, or how to treat it. There's no great mystery about heart disease, stroke, or most forms of cancer. The leading cause of cancer is lung cancer. We know exactly what causes it. We know exactly what to do, and we are doing the right things in many, many countries. We are applying this knowledge. Cancer death rates in the United States are declining. Heart disease death rates in the United States have gone down by 60% in the last 30 years. Huge achievement. So I think we know what to do. That's why I'm cautiously optimistic. The problems are that we're having difficulty applying that knowledge to the rest of the world. And the future of chronic diseases depends on what we do in China, what the Chinese do in China, what the Indians do in India. But I think there is a growing desire to learn the lessons from the more privileged countries and apply it appropriately in other countries. That's why I'm cautiously optimistic. There's a huge challenge for us, and we have to take these issues seriously. We need more resources. We need the support of the wealthy countries. WHO can't do anything by itself. It's a very small organization, has few resources, but it can work with wealthy partners.
And I need to jump in and thank you all for joining us. Hami Jaffrey, chief of the Polio Eradication Branch at CDC and Prevention in Atlanta. Robert Beaglehold, director of the Department of Chronic Diseases and Health Promotion at WHO in Geneva. Also Jim Kim, director of the Department of HIV/AIDS at WHO in Geneva. Thank you all.
Ira, can I have 2 seconds?
Two.
Okay. I would just say this. Optimism in our business is a moral choice, not an analytical result.
Okay.
We must be optimistic.
Okay. You have no other choice.
right.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. If you missed any of our program, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave us all kinds of email. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.